You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. A recent poll found that 95% of Americans polled found misinformation to be a problem when they are trying to access important information. However, the same poll found only two in ten Americans think they've spread misinformation themselves. 6 in 10 do believe, though, that their friends and family have spread misinformation. That poll is from the Associated Press Norick Center for Public Affairs and the Peterson Institute. On today's Smart Talk, we focus on why misinformation is so prevalent, why it's spread on social media, and what role misinformation plays in our lives with two distinguished guests today. Joining us, Dr. Dana Gao-Young, Professor of Communication and Political Science at the University of Delaware, where she studies the content, audience, and effects of non-traditional political information, and she's the author of the book Irony and Outrage, The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter. Also joining us is Dr. Sinan Arol, Professor of Management, Marketing, and IT at the MIT Sloan School of Management and author of the book The Hype Machine, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Dr. Young, let me start with you. This seems like a simple definition or explanation, but how do you define misinformation?
Well, there's a distinction to be made between misinformation and disinformation, which folks often mistake one for the other. Misinformation is information that is demonstrably inaccurate based on available empirical observation, but that is spread incidentally, accidentally by individuals. So the individuals who are sharing that information that is empirically inaccurate do not know that it is empirically inaccurate. So this would include things like what is shared by a relative on Facebook, right? Like your Aunt Sue, who shares something that is untrue about a COVID vaccine. Disinformation, on the other hand, is information that is deliberately spread and knowingly false. So a lot of times misinformation that we encounter online that is empirically demonstrably false, it might be misinformation from Aunt Sue, but when you trace it back and you look to the origins of that information, it's actually disinformation that originated by some individual entity or some organization with the goal of misinforming people. And that's disinformation.
That poll that I cited, 6 in 10 Americans think that their family or friends have spread misinformation. So Aunt Sue would be part of that.
Yeah, poor Aunt Sue. But you know what struck me about that actually, Scott, was when you said most people actually don't believe that they themselves have spread misinformation. Unfortunately, this is an effect that we find in most media research, and that is that we tend to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, and this is called a third person effect, where we will underestimate the extent to which we ourselves are complicit in something or affected by something or engaging in a bad behavior. We think other people do it more.
Dr. Arol, your book, The Hype Machine, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. Misinformation today seems to be spread most often on social media. You have done a lot of research into this. What have you found about social media and misinformation?
Thanks, Scott. Yes, indeed. We actually did a study with Twitter, which we published back in 2018 in Science Magazine, where we studied all of the verified true and false news stories that ever spread on Twitter from its inception in 2006 to 2017. A huge trough of data. We actually worked with Twitter and had access to their historical archives, so it could really uncover basically every tweet. And what we found there was really shocking and scary. We found that false news traveled farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than the truth in every category of information that we studied, and that false political news was the most viral. It went farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than any other type of false news. And this result has been replicated by other teams over and over again. And in essence, what we're finding is that the truth cannot catch up to falsity fast enough on social media, that falsity travels like lightning through these social media pipes, but the truth drips along like molasses, which makes fact-checking and debunking very difficult.
I'm curious, you said you went all the way back to 2006 when Twitter started. Did you see any trends in your research, like a certain time when maybe political news, you know, or misinformation about politics became more prevalent? Or, you know, was there another topic that misinformation spread quicker in the early years?
100%. We've seen increases in misinformation over those 10 years, and we've seen spikes that correspond to electoral events. For instance, the 2012 and 2016 presidential elections in the United States, as well as geopolitical events. So my book opens with the story of Crimea, the Russian annexation of Crimea. And there we actually delve deep into what is the largest known spike in mixed news, which is stories that contain partially true and partially false misinformation. And this spike in mixed news, which was the largest over the 10 years that we studied, was four times larger than any other spike in mixed news. And it only around for 2 months. During the 2 months of the annexation of Crimea. And when we dug into those stories that made up that spike of mixed news, we found stories that were essentially almost verbatim mirroring what Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, was saying in public appearances at the UN and at other places. And this just tells a fascinating and, again, scary tale of the use of social media to spread what Dr. Young called disinformation in order to change political outcomes. And I say that because if you remember, the Obama doctrine stopped short of intervening in Crimea to reverse the annexation. And the reason for that was because this misinformation campaign, this disinformation campaign, essentially changed our perception of the reality, both on the ground and in international circles, and painted it more as instead of an annexation, it was an accession. In other words, painting the picture that Crimean citizens wanted to join Russia, and that made it harder to intervene.
Actually, you know, I was just thinking about that as you were describing the story. I mean, that seems to be the story that has stuck with we Americans, is that Crimea wanted so much to be part of Russia. But that's a great story and a great example of how we Americans probably think this is an American thing when it isn't. I mean, what you just pointed out, that that was something that had a great impact on a worldwide scale, and it didn't involve the United States at all. So, by the way, if you're just tuning in, our guest today, Dr. Dannegar Young, who is professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, where she studies the content, audience, and effects of non-traditional political information. She's author of the book Irony and Outrage, The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter. And Dr. Sanan Arol, a professor of management, marketing, and IT at the MIT Sloan School of Management, author of the book The Hype Machine. Dr. Young, as I've been reading about some of the things that you've written and talked about when it comes to misinformation, there seems to be some psychology behind misinformation as opposed to disinformation, which Dr. Arol just pointed out when we were talking about Russia. But there seems to be some psychology behind why people latch on to misinformation and spread misinformation. What is that psychology?
Sure. So before I answer that question, if I could just dovetail off of something that you were just discussing with regards to sort of the global aspect of the misinformation problem. In light of the testimony from Frances Haugen, who was the whistleblower last week, the Vice President of Communications, Global Communications at Facebook, Nick Clegg, issued a rebuttal that the American problem is clearly an American problem and is not the result of Facebook. And his explanation or his justification for saying that was that we don't see these same issues of misinformation in other parts of the world that also have Facebook, which I thought was a very peculiar defense because that is simply untrue. And what we know through a century of quantitative research on media effects is that media technologies interact with the political and cultural context in which they find themselves. And so what you end up finding is that Facebook causes all kinds of different problems in different parts of the world based on the nature of the political and cultural conflicts that already exist. So you see issues like in Myanmar, Sri Lanka, India, and the United States. You see what we saw, for example, with the annexation of Crimea. In those different contexts, Facebook does amplify these cycles of misinformation. I just wanted to put that out there because I thought it's just funny because Clegg is often saying, but you know, it doesn't happen in other places. So it must be America's fault.
Well, let me follow up on that, because what you're describing when you say it was just untrue, their reasoning seems to be that the polarization of America is the problem and not Facebook's contribution to that polarization.
Right. And right now, so there are countless scholars working in this area, and serious scholars of these questions say, yes, polarization is a problem. Actually, it's anti-democratic behaviors and a pushback against pluralist democracy that is a problem, and that those exist because of the context that we're in, a historical context that we are in, and other kinds of complicated factors. However, Facebook cannot wash its hands of this completely. There is no serious scholar of these questions who completely denies that social media technologies play some kind of a role. And to be sort of deterministic and black and white about it and say it's either Facebook or it's America just doesn't make sense, because these are synergistic forces that work in an interactive way together. Yeah, that's what I'll say.
Okay, well, before we get into the psychology, then let me just ask Dr. Arol, who's done so much research on this, if you have thoughts on that, what Dr. Young was saying as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with everything she just said. It is definitely an international problem. In the book, I talk about India. I talk about elections in Germany. I talk about the Brexit vote in the UK. I talk about Crimea. It's all over the world. The spread of misinformation is definitely not isolated and only happening in the United States. That is patently false. And in addition, you know, the vast majority of Facebook users are outside of the United States, and this is a connected network. Information flows across borders with, you know, you don't need a passport with an email or with a Facebook message to get across a border. The other thing is that I also agree that the causes and consequences of polarization in the United States are complex. So when you look into the research on it, there are a number of generational issues that contribute to polarization, including how people decided to move towards people like themselves and created geographies that were clustered on one political dimension or another. The rise of cable news networks that exaggerated political opinions in one direction or another, and so on. But at the end of the day, when you look at very large-scale experiments that have been done on Facebook and in other social media platforms, you see that Facebook and other social media platforms do contribute to political polarization. And it's a complex subject, but the role of Facebook is also quite real. And there's two ways that Facebook and other social media platforms contribute to polarization. The first is through what are known as friend suggestion algorithms, or PYMK, people you may know algorithms. These algorithms suggest who to connect to next, and they form the lion's share of new connections. The way these algorithms work is they tend to recommend people that are like you. And as they recommend people that are like you, and as you overly take their recommendations, which is statistically true, it creates what's known as homophily and clustering. Homophily just means birds of a feather flock together. So more Republicans become friends with more Republicans, and more Democrats become friends with more Democrats. And they make these tight-knit clusters that create echo chambers of information inside Facebook and other social media platforms. The second way they do it is through what are known as feed algorithms. These are what control what you see in your newsfeed. And essentially, these algorithms are designed to, they are complex optimization processes, but the bottom line is they give you more of what you say you want by clicking, linking, sharing, liking content. And as you do that, it creates filter bubbles. You get more exaggerated content as you decide or describe what you like through what you consume and engage with. Those two things in combination contribute to polarization through social media.
Interesting. I want to get back, Dr. Young, to the question I had asked a little bit earlier. And this is important. The psychology of misinformation. There seems to be a reason psychologically that people will believe misinformation, spread misinformation. Why?
Good. We want to feel safe. We want to feel smart, and we want to feel respected. And so all of those things, but notice I say we want to feel these things. We don't necessarily want to be smart or be right. We want to feel smart and right and safe. As a result, we will tend to, you know, there's this concept called confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, where we will tend to look at the world and see what we want to see. We'll tend to find things that confirm our worldview is correct. What happens with misinformation is that it usually satisfies some kind of a need. And the conditions when we see misinformation really take hold are when our psychological needs are especially acute. So if we feel uncertain, or we feel unsafe, or we feel isolated, those social needs and those sort of identity needs are going to translate into us actually looking for narratives that make us feel better. And a lot of times those narratives that are offered to us that actually make us feel better are narratives that contain false information. So if you think about the context of COVID and you think about the last almost 2 years now, we're in what really many people describe as a perfect storm for misinformation, because there is an actual threat that is ambiguous and that we don't really understand. It is creating complete upheaval and uncertainty. Our lives are being disrupted. We're socially isolated from one another. We're not engaging in incidental social interactions with folks unlike us. We are really limited to our online interactions in many ways. So social media play more of a role, which, remember, foster those same problems that Professor Aral just talked about. So all of these things together, especially in the context of a very heated political environment with a political leader who was, I mean, we can't deny the role of elite voices here. We had a political leader who was himself fueling misinformation, both in the realm of health and in the realm of politics. And when disinformation comes from on high, it has a disproportionate effect. It's very compelling, even more so than your Aunt Sue.
You mentioned confirmation bias. Something that seems to go along with that and the psychology that you talked about is that there are people that, when confronted with the truth or facts, well, they won't go away from the misinformation in which they have accepted or they have spread. Why?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, if you think about it, a lot of this comes down to, well, there's a couple of things here. Let me talk about a concept called epistemic motivations. Okay. People have different ways of coming to truth, and many of us engage in different methods of coming to truth. But the two basic ways are some folks go based on their intuition and their emotions, and they sort of make deductions based on the values that they hold. And then they deduce things that they believe are true. that just makes sense to them. Other folks might engage in sort of empirical processing. They'll observe the world. They'll try to disconfirm whether or not they think that whether or not the thing that they believe is true is really true. This is sort of more akin to a scientific process, right? Where you're adjusting your beliefs based on empirical evidence. We find that there is this divide in how people come to understand the world. When you couple that first way of coming to truth, right, through intuition and without allowing the empirical world to interrupt your conclusions, how people trust authorities and institutions becomes paramount, because that usually becomes the place from which we derive our understanding of truth. So I trust scientists. I trust government officials. Therefore, when they speak with authority about issues or proclamations or truths, I then deduce that that is true, right? If you are an individual who does not trust in authority and you value your ability to make up your own mind and you think everyone is out for themselves and they're large conspiracies in the shadows, it almost makes it even less likely that any of the evidence that will be brought to bear on your beliefs could ever change your mind because you do not trust the source. So when you engage in deductive reasoning, you say, well, if a scientist says this, I know they're in the pocket of Big Pharma. Or if the president says this, I know he just wants to get reelected. And then all of that empirical evidence doesn't matter to you.
We're going to be taking your phone calls and emails in just a moment. Dan will be with you in just a moment. I want to follow up on that, Dr. Rowe, that something that Dr. Young just said that, again, you have written about, that you have said that people don't take the time to think or analyze what they're reading or what they have heard on social media, that they may not be as accepting of misinformation if they did. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, when I think about the psychology of misinformation, three things jump out at me, and that's novelty, reactivity, and identity. So we wrote about something called the novelty hypothesis. So if you read the cognitive science literature, you know that human attention is drawn to novelty, what's new in the environment. And if you read the sociology literature, you know that we gain in status when we share novel information because we're seen as being, quote unquote, in the know or having access to inside information. And this raises our status with our friends when we share this type of information with them. So in our big study of Twitter, we evaluated the novelty hypothesis, and indeed, we did find that on three different measures of novelty, false news was significantly more novel than the truth. And that's not surprising because it's completely unconstrained by reality. It could be about anything and totally made up. And so novelty, when we see something novel running across our social media feed, it draws our attention, and then we want to share it because we know we're going to gain in status if we tell people something that they don't know or we're the source of new information that other people haven't heard before. The second is what you're talking about, which is reactivity. So large-scale experiments that we've done at the Initiative on the Digital Economy, which I direct at MIT, demonstrate that when people are in a reflective mode, they are less likely to believe or share misinformation. And when they're in a reactive mode, what Nobel Prize winning economist Danny Kahneman has called type one and type two thinking, type one being reactive, type two being slow, deliberative, and reflective. So when you nudge people to be reflective or to think about accuracy by asking them every so often in the feed, does this seem accurate to you? They get into a mode of reflection and wanting to think about whether it's accurate. And then over the next many articles that they see, they're less likely to believe misinformation and less likely to share it. And then finally is identity. The reason that people can't drop their beliefs is because it gets wrapped up in their identity, that my crowd, my tribe believes this. And therefore, when somebody tells me something contrary, It not only affects my belief about the world and my facts, et cetera, but it actually attacks the core of my identity, which I have wrapped up in what I believe. And that makes dislodging belief and misinformation that much harder.
Let's take a phone call from Dan in Akron. Dan, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for this program. I had two comments. One was regarding Richard Nixon, who years ago when he was president made a statement that the politician's best friend is the short attention span of the electorate. And once you put something out there, it's believed and it's harder to recant what was put out there. And speaking of the coronavirus, I found a newspaper the other day from 2013 about MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. And they found that in Saudi Arabia, the rate of infection was higher in men than from women because the women were wearing veils. And it was 80-some percent versus the women. And the misinformation today about wearing something over your face, that just blew that out of the water. And that's about it. Thank you, guys.
Hey, Dan, thank you very much for your call. What Dan brings up, the first thing about being attributed to former President Nixon, that the American people have a short attention span. And maybe I'll expand on that. Are we just talking about Americans, or are we talking about people around the world? Dr. Arulf, this kind of goes back to what you were just saying about being reflective, being reactive, and, what about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's globally true that these attention span, we're all very busy, obviously. We don't have a lot of time to verify every single piece of information that comes across our mental, space. When you look at debunking, what you find is that debunking does actually have the ability and the potential to slow down the spread of misinformation, but it is vastly overwhelmed by the misinformation itself. And debunking information rarely catches up to the misinformation that it's trying to debunk. And that's because once somebody spends a little bit of time thinking about a topic, they don't really have the time to go into the second order, the third order, and the fourth order research. And so they just believe the first thing that they hear more often than not, and they're less likely, unless they're in that reflective mode, unless they have put some effort into it, to listen to the debunking information or to do something that would debunk. Now, I'll just say one last thing, which is that a very large fraction of the misinformation that you see on social media can be very easily debunked by a single Google search. That if you just did a Google search on it, you'd see debunking misinformation all the time. So one advice I give to people is, I always see this whenever I see misinformation on my social media, people in my community share it and they say, I don't know if this is true, but it's really interesting if it is. And my advice to those people is, before you do that, just stop and do one Google search. 80% of the time, you'll stop yourself from sharing misinformation if you find it debunked.
But Dr. Young, go ahead.
Could follow up on that just for a second. Can I tell you what I'm really worried about?
Sure.
This is what I'm really worried about. So I'm working on a new book project called Wrong, How Identity Fuels Misinformation and How to Fix It. And so when Professor Arulf talked about the sort of, if you give just an accuracy prompt, right, and it gets people to engage in this reflective thinking, which is great. And, I've looked at a lot of the work by Rand and Pennycook in this area, and it's these interventions are amazing, and they're so easy. All you have to do is barely nudge someone, and then it shifts how they approach the information. It's awesome. Here's what I'm worried about. What if we are living in such a sort of bifurcated political and cultural world where identity drives everything, that engaging in reflective thinking itself becomes part of that identity, such that, and this is where, the work of Oliver and Wood here is really important. The idea that right now, when you have a Republican Party that is overwhelmingly homogenous in terms of evangelical Christianity, there are certain ways of coming to truth that map onto those belief systems. And those ways of coming to truth are themselves based on intuition and a bit of fatalism. If that is how you come to truth, then that is going to be then your way of knowing is itself going to be an identity factor. And that's where I'm like, you know, we have a lot of social scientists who themselves are thinking, no, accuracy prompts and reflective thinking, these are neutral values. We should all want these. I don't think that that is actually how they play out on the ground. I think that reflective thinking itself and being motivated towards accuracy is itself perhaps a liberal psychological luxury, because liberals are not motivated by threat monitoring. And so they have the time to figure out, is this true or not? I don't know. So that's where my concerns lie.
So what you're saying is that, and forgive me for comparing it to the Facebook response, is that America is so tribal now, and it seems that our tribes are growing further apart and stronger. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and we know that that is true. There's amazing work by Liliana Mason looking at the internal homogeneity of our political parties over time, and homogeneity on really important stuff like religion, race, where we choose to live, aspects of identity that are sort of fundamental to how we think of ourselves and categorize ourselves. And the more that those sort of primal dimensions of identity become synonymous with politics, the more dangerous all of these things become, and the more exploitable they become by not just algorithms, but also by political leaders seeking to sort of mobilize different groups based on those primal identity factors.
Let's take a phone call from Lenore in Lancaster. Lenore, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi there. Great topic.
Thank you.
I'm a community and religious educator, and I'm thinking about how we can equip our kids for living in this, kids and adults too, living in this landscape of misinformation. And I saw a study recently that made me think about how we do this. It was about how typically we're teaching people how to do very close reads of like a news item or of a text. And that's actually not the best strategy, that it's better to actually stop reading partway through and then start reading something else that on that topic from a more trusted source. And I'm just concerned about how can we teach people better? How can we be smarter?
Dr. Young, do you want to handle that one?
Sure, I can chime in. So yeah, no, I'm glad that you asked that question and that you're so engaged with some of the research in this area. There are various strategies that I think have been tried. That what makes me a little bit nervous about media literacy efforts is that a lot of times when you're telling people to be critical consumers of information, if they're being critical based on their own value system and beliefs, then what you're actually doing is encouraging sort of motivated reasoning and confirmation bias even more, right? So you be a critical consumer of news. Okay, I'm going to go in with a critical eye and believe what I want to believe. What actually helps is, like you said, disrupting your sort of natural inclination, which might be to process that information according to your beliefs. Instead, step away, consult a different source, and see what they have to say about it. Where I approach this, though, is through sort of a different pathway, which is about the values that you bring to the table when you're consuming information. If something gets you excited or angry or intrigued, right? These three things that Professor Earle's talking about, the novelty, reactivity, and identity. If you feel those things are ignited within you, can you stop and say, what is it that is making me feel this way right now? Why do I want to share this? Why do I want to react to it? Why do I want my friends to know that I'm seeing this? One thing that's helpful, I find, is a value called epistemic humility, which is the notion that maybe I am wrong. Being open to the idea that maybe I'm wrong is a huge gift, because then you will not be so confident in your assertion of truth, and you will not be so confident in your sharing of the information. So I have two children, and they are in middle and high school, and they have written countless quote unquote persuasive essays where they have a point of view and they have to argue that that point of view is correct, and I'm tired of it. And what I would like to see my children come home having written an essay on what their point of view is and what the opposite point of view is, and what evidence could be brought to bear that would convince them that their own point of view is incorrect. Mm.
Lenore, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Young, to follow up on that, and both of you, we haven't talked specifically about sources, but how does one know if the information they're getting on social media, for example, is coming from a reliable source? Because if I watch Fox News to get most of my news, I think that Fox News is a reliable source. If I watch MSNBC to rely on my news, I think that's a reliable source. How is one to know what is reliable?
I'm going to let you take this one. That's hard.
So one thing that I noticed when I was thinking about this is that we have had, and it goes to the question of how do we, you know, teach future generations as well. I think we really need to understand more fundamentally the provenance of the information that we are consuming. And we have to have our kids educated more thoroughly about things like standards of evidence and what makes a particular argument, say, strong or weak and why, not just about persuasion. So it's not just about kind of emotional appeals or things like that, but what makes a particular statement or argument weak or strong based on sort of standards of evidence. Now, when it comes to reliable sources, compare and contrast the consumption, our consumption of information with our consumption of food. When you go to the grocery store to buy food to consume, it's extensively labeled by law. You know how many calories it has, how many trans fats it has, whether it was produced in a facility that produces wheat or peanuts if you have an allergy. But when it comes to the information we consume, we have none of that information with which to make any sort of educated decision about what is this that I'm putting in my body, in my brain, as opposed to what I'm putting in my stomach. I think we need better systems for labeling the provenance of the information that we're consuming that include things like, what are the standards of evidence of this publication? In other words, how many independent sources do they require to run with a story? How many people worked on this story? How many people did they interview for this story? What are the qualifications of the people that they interviewed for this story? What are the qualifications of the investigative journalists in this subject matter area? What are the publishing standards of the journal or the place where the information is coming from? Now, obviously, nobody can read all of that every time they read an article, but I think summaries of that. One thing that these platforms are extremely good at is summarizing complex information in the form of symbols and little tickers and even emojis and things like that, which capture a ton of information. So labeling, which consists of summaries of all of that information in a way that allows us to know more about the provenance of the information before we consume it, akin to labeling of food in the grocery store.
But I like that a lot. And I'm just going to add to that an understanding of the economic dynamics underneath a media system is imperative. It's wild to me that our children consume so much media all the time. And when I teach my first year students in my big media and society course, they have very little understanding of how money changes hands to get that information in front of you. They do not recognize the notion that they are the product, their eyeballs are the product that is bought and sold. So once you orient yourself to a media system through that lens, it changes how you think about yourself and it changes how you think about the content. And I think if we had more information, for example, about, okay, who is the intended audience for this and why? What kind of money are they making through this content? What is the target demographic of this particular content. That then would enhance our understanding based on the criteria that you were just discussing, like the food label on the content.
All right. So talking about social media in particular, and I want to talk about, we have a question from a listener about newspapers, but I want to talk about social media in particular. What incentive do they have, the social media platforms, for stopping misinformation? I mean, Facebook has talked about things that they've instituted. Twitter has banned Donald Trump and a lot of other people. But what incentive do they have when they are looking to make money, get eyeballs on their site, to have clicks, as many clicks as they can get? What incentive do they have for stopping misinformation?
So if I could, because I think this is one of the most fundamental questions around how are we going to restructure social media to achieve its promise and avoid its peril. There is no current incentive for these platforms to change, and there are a number of reasons for that. The main reason for that is that there's no competition in this economy. There are a few very large players, and the entire social media economy runs on what economists call network effects, which means that the value of one of these platforms is a function of how big it is. The bigger it is, the more powerful it is, and the more valuable it is. It makes it very difficult to leave any one of these large platforms because all of your friends are there. You can't communicate with them if you leave that particular platform. And so we have to do something about the market concentration problem because there are lots of startups out there that I see every single day that have really good ideas for bringing new innovations to the social media economy that could help fix some of the problems that we see. But none of these startups are going to get any of the oxygen they need to survive or succeed because of the current market concentration that we see. So we have to do something about market concentration in order to force these companies to compete with new entrants that will provide some of the things that the consumers have been demanding for years but not getting. Reductions in misinformation, you know, reductions in bullying and hate speech and all the things that everybody is so up in arms about. The mental health effects on our kids that the Wall Street Journal has done such great investigative journalism about, the things that the whistleblower has detailed in congressional testimony and so on. You can tell that consumers are angry, but they don't have any other outside options because there's no competition. The second thing that and we can talk about how we achieve that because I have a lot of very detailed thoughts about that. But the second thing I think that we absolutely need now is transparency. We're trying to figure out if cigarettes cause cancer, but we don't have access to what's in the cigarettes. And so we need regulation that brings crowbars to the front doors of these companies and opens them up for us to be able to understand how these algorithms work, how the data works, what the implications are, what are the effects on mental health, what are the effects on democracy, what are the effects on public health, what are the effects on our economies. And we cannot currently study that under the current transparency rules that exist, which are essentially none. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Roll, you mentioned algorithms, and we only have about 5 minutes left in the program, so I wanted to get to this because Congress last week, when there was a testimony from the whistleblower from Facebook, you know, one of the things they talked about was regulating the algorithms that Facebook has. Now, first of all, I have to say that I don't know quite how a government entity could do that, but tell us about that. Is that one of the keys to reining Facebook in and controlling misinformation?
Well, possibly, but I would say we're not sure. And the reason for that is because we have no transparency to understand either the algorithms or their effects in any real detail that would support such regulation. We don't even know if the algorithms have the effects that people claim they have. You know, some people, you know, the whistleblower, you know, brought a lot of quote unquote inside research, which is definitely inside research. But they are surveys asking people to self-report their mental health. And these are people who already have self-selected to signal that they have had mental health problems recently. So it's a very skewed sample in that specific large-scale survey that has been widely cited in the Wall Street Journal. But real studies could be done to find out what the mental health effects are, and we shouldn't be ad hoc regulating algorithms, which is a very strong step, without knowing what we're doing. We can't know what we're doing until we have the transparency. You know, cigarettes were regulated after there was extensive research done that demonstrated what the effects were and weren't, and then there were regulations. And I think that is the same process that we need to follow now, and we need to do it quickly. This can't be a long, laborious process. Congress needs to act right away to create transparency. That transparency needs to create robust science around what the effects are and why they occur, and that needs to drive regulation.
Dr. Young, we have about 2 minutes. We have a listener, Joe, who asked, why newspaper media is no longer the go-to source of journalistic news that is typically more accurate?
Oh, there are many reasons why. Well, one is consolidation of ownership in the industry and the decimation of local newspapers. And Craigslist destroyed the advertising revenue, and I could go on and on. I mean, the newspaper, one of the greatest tragedies in terms of our information environment is the death of the local newspaper. And that has fueled mistrust, distrust, citizens who feel disconnected. It's fueled the nationalization of politics. So people don't feel connected to their local or state politics. Instead, they're only connected at the national level, where they don't feel like they have efficacy or the ability to really affect change. That fuels alienation. All of these things are the result of some economic changes and devastation in the journalism industry. Mm. I will say, when it comes to investigative reporting at the national level, our legacy newspapers are still driving that. You know, we talked about the Wall Street Journal series of investigative reports on Facebook. The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and New York Times really are still leading the way in terms of investigative reporting. But where we need that more is at the local level, where actually the dynamics of government affect the daily lives of citizens even more.
I want to thank both our guests. I wish we had much more time because there's so much more to discuss. Dr. Danigo Young, who is professor of communication political science at the University of Delaware, where she studies the content, audience, and effects of non-traditional political information. Author of the book, Irony and Outrage, The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter. And Dr. Sinan Arul, professor of management, marketing, and IT at the MIT Sloan School of Management. The author of the book, The Hype Machine, How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. Again, thank both of you for being with us today. A great conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.